Welcome to episode 3 of the Americas Uncovered podcast, where we explore important current political issues and historical trends in the Americas with some of the authors and specialists who understand them best. This is a podcast for Alborada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media and culture based in the UK. I'm Peter Watt and I teach and research Latin American studies at the University of Sheffield in the UK. You can follow Alborada on Facebook and Twitter, and if you like this podcast, please subscribe wherever you're listening or watching. As the mainstream media comes increasingly under the control of powerful corporate interests, the role of independent journalism has never been more important. So you can help Alborada to continue offering perspectives rarely found in the mainstream media by becoming a regular supporter or through a one-off donation at alborada.net. Many thanks to those of you who do so already. My guest today is Alex Avina. He is an associate professor of Latin American history in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at Arizona State University. He is author of Spectres of Revolution, which is the book we're talking about today. The book chronicles the subaltern political history of peasant guerrilla movements that emerged in the southwestern Mexican state of Guerrero during the late 1960s. The book reveals that revolutionary movements in the state developed after years of exhausting legal, constitutional pathways of redress, focused on issues of economic justice and electoral rights, and surviving several state-directed massacres throughout the 1960s. As such, the peasant guerrillas represented only the final phase of a social process with roots in the unfulfilled promises of the 1910 Mexican Revolution and the dual capitalist modernization political authoritarian program adopted by the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or the PRI, after 1940. At the local and regional levels, parts of Mexico like Guerrero experienced instances of authoritarian rule, popular political radicalization, and brutal counterinsurgency that fully inserts the nation into a Cold War Latin American history of state terror and dirty wars. This study simultaneously exposes the violent underbelly that underscored the PRI's ruling tenure after 1940 and explodes the myth that Mexico constituted an island of relative peace and stability surrounded by a sea of military dictatorships during the Cold War. Alex, great to see you again, and welcome to the Americas Uncovered podcast. Hope you're doing well. I just finished your book, Spectres of Revolution, which I thought was truly excellent. Really enjoyed looking at through the history of revolutionary guerrero in Mexico. So I thought we could maybe discuss your book and then look at, you know, talk about what you're currently doing. But I was wondering, you know, a little bit about your personal journey, which you allude to at the beginning of the book. I think in the acknowledgements you talk about your parents as being kind of your teachers and the first historians you kind of learned from. So I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about the trajectory of your own life and how that led you to write this book.
Well, thank you so much, Peter, for the invitation, and it's good to see you again after a bunch of years. Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to talk about this book. So my personal journey, and I do go into it, I think, in the acknowledgements, because I think it's a key component in terms of how I became a historian, is that my parents are from the Mexican state of Michoacán on the western coast of Mexico, and they migrated without papers to the United States in the 1970s, just in time for me to be born in the U.S. So I grew up in California in an undocumented household, well, mixed status, right? With the kids, we were all citizens. My parents were always under threat of deportation. My parents had really didn't have much in the way of formal schooling. Like, my father had 1 year of primary school. My mother made it through primary school, so through sixth grade. But I learned a lot about Mexican history through them. And then later on in my life, I discovered that they were telling me like very periodista, nationalistic versions of Mexican history, but it's it was their way of trying to impress upon us the idea that we were Mexicans living in another country. So they did their best to teach us what they viewed as like how to be Mexican, what was Mexican history, what was Mexican culture. That involved a lot of soccer, a lot of football, and a lot of Televisa, which is, again, once I went to college and studied this history in a more academic, critical way, we had some interesting talks when I would come back home from university. So there was a lot of stories in my house, a lot of stories about Mexican history, about Michoacan. And then periodically, particularly once my parents received official status in the 90s, we would travel more to Mexico. And there I would spend just hours listening to my maternal grandfather, Pedro Godinez, just tell me these amazing stories. Like, to me, he's the best storyteller that I've met, I think. And he was a sharecropper all his life. He died illiterate. He never had any formal schooling. But he's a brilliant man, brilliant storyteller. And through him, I started getting these stories of like bad men in Mexican history, outlaws, right? Men, particularly men, there's a strong gender component. Men who stood up to oppression or stood up to the government and just said no and used violence as a way to get back. And that's how I started through these stories, through corridos, through music. I started getting these stories of individuals like Lucio Cabañas and Genaro Vázquez, these two school teacher turned guerrilla leaders that I chronicle in the book. In grad school, when I started researching this project, thinking about like where the hell did I get this idea? Subconsciously, I think there was always this cultural, historical memory that my family imparted upon me that maybe led me toward the histories of people who stood up to power and tried to to take a stand and create a better life, not just for them, but for their communities and for their country.
And this was very much a kind of hidden history. The first time I heard about the Mexican Dirty War was I was living in the States, studying in the States, and I was talking to a Mexican friend, and I was thinking, well, he was suggesting I do a PhD, and I said, yeah, I don't really have a topic, I don't really know what I would do, and he said, why don't you do something about the Mexican Dirty War? And I said, I never knew anything about the Mexican Dirty War, and this was 20 years ago, I think, and what always struck me about those stories that you recount so well in the book is the extent to which the outside world knew nothing really about this and probably didn't care that much. So was that one of the reasons that you embarked on this project?
Yeah, I think so. I think because I come from a family of essentially landless campesinos who had to migrate in search of a better life, I think that helped influence my desire as a historian to look at kind of these hidden histories of just everyday people whose struggles, whose ideas, whose intellectual contributions to Mexico have been largely marginalized, right? And I started thinking about Guerrero primarily because of my dad, because he grew up with a bunch of kids from Guerrero. And I grew up hearing these stories of like, you never mess with someone from Guerrero because they fight with machetes. That's like literally what my father would tell me. I'm like, man, what is... I thought people from Michoacan were badass. Like, what's going on in Guerrero? And then when I was an
undergraduate... The name of the state says it all.
Right. Yeah, the name. And then as an undergraduate, I remember writing a paper on the student massacre, October 2nd, 1968 student massacre. And there was a line in one of the things that I read that said, some people went into the mountains to become guerrillas. And I was like, wait, what? I've never heard that story, right? How can a supposedly post-revolutionary state that proclaims itself to be the revolution embodied, how could then that generate other revolutionaries up in the mountains in the late 60s and early 70s? And then that movie, Amores Perros, came out. And if you know the character of El Chivo, a lot of my attempt to recover the history of the armed guerrilla left in Mexico is my effort to like kind of yell at that character. Because I remember watching that movie thinking, man, this is some bullshit. But it's a powerful film. It's a powerful story. But I remember really being bothered by that narrative of really the guerrillero arrepentido, right? The repentant guerrilla who sees the later in life after much suffering and trauma, sees the heirs, his youthful heirs of trying to change the system through armed struggle. I became obsessed to extend by the history of this state of Guerrero, because I think within the historiography of Guerrero, as it is politically, culturally, socially, it's one of the most marginalized states in Mexico, even though historically it occupies such a central place in this thing that we call Mexico. It's at the center of every big transformation or movement to make the to move the country forward, right? From the Manila Galleon of the colonial era all the way to today. But for a variety of reasons, it's neglected, it's marginalized by historians, politicians, everyday people alike.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, one of the points you make is, I mean, there's this discrepancy in a way between the 1968 massacre of students just before the Olympics, which is much better known, really, in Mexico and probably and in the outside world, compared to this story in Guerrero. But one of the things you talk about is the extent to which that spirit of radicalism and of revolutionary potential goes way back. And so you say, well, there were a number, you know, were there a number of student movements, not student movements, but other radical movements from the 40s onwards. Mm-hmm. And do you think that spirit of rebellion goes back even further? Does it go way back into the colonial period, given that the structures of power in the Mexican countryside were kind of a semi-feudal system? And, you know, people know, you know, there were such inequalities, racial and economic, that presumably people were rebelling all the time throughout that period.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes. And if I'd had another 100,000 words from the editor, from the editor, I would have, you know, because in my dissertation that became the book, I really dive into the longer history of campesino rural popular rebellions in the state of Guerrero before it even existed as a state, right? It officially becomes a state in the mid-19th century. But when I was developing this project, I kept trying to figure out, and this is like a thing that historians have to do, like, where do we begin? And I would get to a begin point and research that, and then figured out that those rebellions at this moment were echoes of a previous rebellion. And I ended up in the late colonial period. Yeah. And really, thanks to the work of people like this great historian, Peter Guardino, who has an amazing book on Guerrero in the late colonial and early 19th century. You know, you figure out that you see these continuities of demands, right? You see, I think in the book, I use like Raymond Williams' model of like emergent and residual political elements, right? These things that that demonstrate these ideas, these banderas, these revolutionary ideas and ways to rebel demonstrate a remarkable continuity across centuries, right? Even though they will pop up again in different contexts and they have to be recontextualized. But there's, for me, especially in Guerrero, you see this remarkable continuity. And that continuity really involves around rural peoples trying to control the means of production to a certain extent. They want to own the land that they work, and they want to just return for the goods that they produce off that land. And this goes back to like Jose Maria Morelos's sentiment of the nation and the Apatzingan Constitution during the Mexican Independence War. I remember getting that point from Adolfo Gili, and I was like, damn, like this is you see echoes of that in these guerrilla movements all the way up in the 1960s and 70s. By the time we get to the 20th century, like obviously the 1910 Mexican Revolution is a huge moment. And I mentioned in the book that people like Lucio Cabañas, they have family members who fought in the Mexican Revolution, particularly some who fought on the Zapatista side. And those ideas then get passed down generationally through oral history, through traditions, through music, that then will reemerge in moments of state terror that then call for a rethinking of how to deal with a government that seems to not be playing by its own rules. And if you protest against them, they pop up and kill you if you are not willing to be co-opted. There's also sites. I think there's also specific institutions and sites where some of these ideas are kept alive, nourished, and then will go out into the broader world. And here I'm talking about these rural teacher training schools that were established in the aftermath of the Mexican Revolution in the 1920s. The idea was to train first the sons and then later the daughters of campesinos to become rural school teachers, and they could go out into the countryside and essentially, you know, preach the gospel of the Mexican Revolution. And as the post-revolutionary state after 1938, 1939 started to go in a more conservative direction, will these schools still maintain alive the most radical interpretations and traditions and legacies of the Mexican Revolution? And it's no surprise then that a school teacher like Lucio Cabañas, who went to one of the more famous schools at Ayotzinapa, which continues to this day to be one of the most famous schools, I mean, that's where he really becomes radically formed, politically formed, at the same time in his case that he's listening to a shortwave radio produced, you know, broadcasting messages and programs from Radio Rebelde in Havana, right? 1958, 1959, yeah. 1960, during the time of the Cuban Revolution. So you have these very localized legacies of rebellion that have survived centuries. You have a very national scope of an increasingly authoritarian Mexican state, and then you have a more transnational leftist revolutionary imaginary that also starts to come in and influence some things.
That role of education, you know, the schools and then the kind of higher education institutions, what do they call them? Escuelas normales or normalistas?
Normales rurales. Yeah.
Normales rurales. And that, you know, that that kind of radicalism of popular education continues right into the present, doesn't it? And I mean, the 2014 terrible disappearance of the 43 students from Ayotzinapa is a reminder of that. But, you know, the role of education seems to be incredibly important in maintaining that sense of identity with these revolutionary causes. I thought that was pretty fascinating, you know, especially when I compare it to the kind of schools that my kids go to. And I don't see the future. I don't see the next Lucio Cabañas coming out there, unless maybe they're keeping it very quiet.
Anyway, so different spaces, man. Different spaces. Yeah,
that's really an interesting discussion of popular education and how people in those communities are kind of consciously trying to understand their own position in society and in the world, and you know, a very different model of education from what we have here, and presumably what you have where you are too. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about Lucio Cabañas and Genaro Vázquez and why they're significant figures, and the movements that they lead are significant, because not everyone listening to this who hasn't read the book will know about those people.
So Genaro Vázquez, I'll start with Genaro Vázquez. Genaro Vázquez is from Southern Guerrero, so closer to the border with Oaxaca. It's called La Costa Chica, the small coast. He leaves that area as a young man in the 1950s, and he goes to the main Normal, the main national teacher training school in Mexico City. And while he's in Mexico City, he becomes, in the 1950s, he becomes involved in a series of really important union struggles and strikes after 1956. Mexico has a really important nationwide railroad worker strike in the late 50s, but there's also a nationwide teacher strike that he becomes involved with. He participates. And, you know, at this point, he's more on the progressive wing of the PRI, you know, maybe on the PPS, this I don't know how you would describe the PPS, Peter, the erstwhile socialist party with close links to the PRI, in many cases receiving direct financing at the leadership level, but at the grassroots level, it ends up producing some really radical militants and cadres. Genaro Vázquez goes back to his state of Guerrero in the late 50s, and he helps organize a broad multi-class civic movement that whose sole demand is to get rid of a state governor who's terribly nepotistic and violent and corrupt. He was a general in the Mexican military. He has a really dark history of repressing popular movements earlier in the 1950s. And this movement manages to spread throughout the state. Genaro Vázquez, as a young man, becomes an important social movement leader in the state of Guerrero. During this movement in 1959, 1960, he meets a young normalista student from Ayotzinapa named Lucio Cabañas, who's a few years younger. And they managed to overthrow this governor. They forced the federal Senate in Mexico to come in and say, this guy's like no good, we're gonna remove him from power. But it took a massacre of protesters at the end of 1960 in the capital city of Chilpancingo. And this is really like one of the first tastes of big military-led instances of state terror against protesters who were like playing by the rules. They were constantly using the 1917 Constitution as their guide and justification for the type of peaceful civic protest that they were launching. And that really launches Genaro Vázquez's career as a social movement leader. Mm-hmm. And what I try to trace in the book is really how each method that he attempts, that he organizes and he uses to reform the PRI, a governing party that had become authoritarian politically, but also adopted a capitalist modernization program that was horrible for the countryside. At each instance, he tried to figure out a new way to deal with this regime and to gain reforms. It was met by increasing levels of state terror, to the point that he's in prison in 1966. And his comrades, earlier comrades from these previous movements, will release him from jail in 1968. They will go up into the mountains and they will form something called La Acción Cívica Nacional Revolucionaria, the ACNR. And this becomes a small, in the book, I characterize them almost like an embryonic guerrilla movement. They never grow beyond, you know, 20 to 30 people up in the mountains of Guerrero. They do manage to establish some urban cells in especially in Mexico City, that were, you know, doing things like bank expropriations, as they called it, robberies, but bank expropriations, I think, is a more
I like that accurate term.
Yeah, me too. I think it's like the Clash's song, right? Like, I like the bank robber stuff. And including the Mexico City cell was led by a woman, by his sister-in-law, who's also, I think, marks an important moment in this, like, the broader Latin American history of the guerrilla, New Left, and the place of gender and women and leading some of these movements that I think gets underplayed until we get to Central America. And for 4 years, this little small group is moving around in the mountains of Guerrero. Their main actions are limited to bank expropriations in the cities and then kidnapping wealthy people in Guerrero as a way to try to finance the movement. They're essentially calling for the installation of socialism in Mexico. They don't use that word in their official 4-point manifesto, but essentially what they're calling for is overthrow of the PRI and a socialist transformation of Mexico. This movement doesn't grow in terms of like its military capacity. It always remains a really small group. By early 1972, you have secret, you know, political police agents on the trail of Genaro Vázquez, and they and apparently some military intelligence agents are chasing Genaro Vázquez out of Guerrero into Morelos, eventually into Michoacán, where on February 2nd, 1972, his car crashes outside of the city of Morelia, and he dies. And that's the official story. When I talked to his lieutenant who was in the car with him, when I talked to Genaro Vázquez's widow, they're convinced that he survived the car crash and that when the military caught up to him, they just lo remataron, right? They just killed him off. And when I was in the archives in Mexico City, like I was able to see the autopsy photos, which are pretty grisly. And I don't know why I kept them. I don't like looking at them. I'm just like, I want to make sure someone has them in case they're like lost. Mm-hmm. Lucio Cabañas followed a different trajectory, particularly because he eventually became, once he graduated from Ayotzinapa, he became a school teacher who was assigned to like teaching in schools in rural places of Guerrero. But he also joined the Mexican Communist Party. Genaro Vázquez always had a love-hate, increasingly hate relationship to the PCM, the Mexican Communist Party. He was very critical of them, especially toward the end of his life. Whereas Lucio Cabañas became one of these, almost like one of these figures out of a José Revueltas novel, right? He's like the good grassroots militant communist who's out in the countryside doing the true work while the leadership in Mexico City is corrupt and they're not actually doing much to advance the revolution. And Lucio Cabañas becomes also involved in land struggles. One of the first towns that he gets assigned to is in the middle of these like lush forests that are being just plundered by a cacique that has links to the high echelons of the PRI. So he becomes involved in that community struggle. Eventually Lucio gets involved in a struggle in the city of Atoyac. It's a very localized struggle where school parents don't like the school rector because she's discriminating against them for being poor. And at one of these, public meetings, these discursos, these speeches, there seems to have been an assassination attempt against Lucio Cabañas because he was just so troublesome. And he manages to escape that shooting. 7 people lose their lives in that massacre. And in May of 1967, and he goes up into the mountains and will then form what I argue in the book is probably the most significant political and military rural guerrilla movement of Mexico, especially after 1940. His little guerrilla group called the Party of the Poor, at its height, probably included between 150 and 200 fighters, at least 25 women. From 1967 up until 1974, at the end of 1974, when Lucio's killed in fighting the military, they're ambushing military units, they're kidnapping and killing hated caciques and police officials who had been involved in earlier massacres of protesters. And they managed to control and gain the support of dozens of rural communities along the Pacific coast of Guerrero. And at the same time, trying to expand out of the state through the creation of urban guerrilla cells in major cities throughout Mexico. And in that, there were various attempts throughout the country. None of them were really successful and kind of taking hold. So that's like the short rundown. And it took, the other thing I talk about in the book is it took the Mexican, what we were talking about, right? This massive dirty war, this orchestrated campaign of state terror and violence in the state of Guerrero led by the Mexican military that looks like what happened in other contemporary Latin American countries then under the rule of military dictatorships, right? The military goes in, possibly up to one third of the Mexican military, about 20,000 troops, thousands of state police, federal police forces. And they use, you know, really brutal counterinsurgency strategies where they attack the civilian base of support of this guerrilla movement. So they do things like burning down entire villages, bombing villages with napalm, disappearing anywhere from 800 to 1,000 people. One of the grisliest tactics that I discovered in the archive was arresting or detaining someone accused of supporting the guerrillas, making them drink gasoline and then lighting them on fire and then dumping their bodies outside of communities as a warning. And apparently this tactic was being used by a shadowy death squad group called Grupo Sangre or Group Blood. So for a long time, right, historiographically and politically, there was a discussion that there was no such dirty war in Mexico because Mexico is radically different from the rest of Latin America. And what I try to show in the book and what I'm doing with my current research is to show that, no, like, Mexico was very much a part of this history of dirty war, state violence, disappearances, et cetera, that characterized much of Latin America during the 60s and 70s and up until the 80s.
Yeah, and, you know, while the other regimes like in Chile and Brazil and Uruguay and Bolivia and Argentina did so under the hammer of military dictatorship, in Mexico, it was done under the guise of this, well, so-called democracy, but an authoritarian democracy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's one of the reasons that, you know, that history that you're talking about was relatively obscure up until not long ago. Was it because the media, which I suppose were mostly based in Mexico City, did they not take an interest in what was happening to a bunch of poor people out in the countryside? Is that why? Were they very Mexico City focused?
Yeah, and I think that continues to this day, right? There's a very Chilango-centric perspective in terms of how Mexican media based in major cities covers what matters in the country. I think I've come to realize, thanks to the work of people like Ben Smith and others, that like that regional newspapers and local newspapers actually did do a lot to make visible this type of violence. Mm-hmm. But it was with some of these major national newspapers who were willingly or unwillingly following the PRI line that really dropped the ball. But you have regional newspapers and local newspapers, like now that we can see by going into the archive, the Hemeroteca, right, in Mexico City, like they were reporting on a lot of this stuff. You also had left-wing, persecuted, highly persecuted, short-lived, usually left-wing magazines and newspapers, right, like Porqué, that were reporting on some of the horrific aspects of this. But ultimately, I think what provided the most cover was that everything I described in terms of the dirty war, the worst part of it happened from 1970 to 1976 when Mexico was ruled by a self-proclaimed leftist, right? Luis Echeverria, who internationally did a lot to position himself as a progressive, as a leftist, as someone who stood up to the United States, as someone who accepting exiles from other Latin American countries. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of Chileans and Argentines who fled the dictatorships right there, Uruguayans, found safe haven in Mexico City. You know, I was at a conference one time when I was presenting this history, and an older, they shall rename nameless, but an older historian of Mexico.
You can name names.
An older historian of Mexico who was commentating on my paper. My paper was about the dirty war in Guerrero and the state of Chihuahua that also experienced a dirty war. The way that this person decided to engage with this history was to make it very personal and say, I did lived and researched in Mexico City during the 1970s, and I never saw any of this. And well, I could go to the bookstore and buy Marx and Engels and whatever leftist propaganda, and nothing would happen to me. And I'm like, yeah, you missed my point. I'm talking about the countryside. I'm talking about some of the most marginalized, isolated areas where the Mexican military in particular felt like it could do whatever it wanted to do. I mean, essentially, the Mexican military was the sovereign power in the state of Guerrero. And I make the argument in the book and my current project that sort of power remains to this day. So whenever we think about like this idea of like Mexico democratizing or going through a democratic transition, I kind of chuckle at that. That idea gets very complicated when you go to a place like Guerrero. So Echeverria on the national and the global stage did a lot to position himself as a leftist, and that gave him a lot of cover, right? There's a famous incident of Salvador Allende before he was overthrown. Visits the university in Guadalajara, And he gives a speech there, and he essentially kind of admonishes Mexican students for the way that they're protesting. Like, you shouldn't be protesting against Echeverria. He's one of us.
So
if you go to the Universidad de Guadalajara, I always get UDG and the Tecos one confused. But there's a statue, a really bad statue of Salvador Allende at this campus commemorating that visit. So Echeverria had a lot of cover. While we now know that secretly, thanks to U.S. declassified documents and the work of historians like Renata Keller, like, secretly he's meeting with Kissinger and with Nixon, and he's basically saying, look, you guys need to support me. Let me be, like, carry the banner of Latin America. And if you don't do that, then it's going to be Fidel Castro. So, like, you know, and we have this long history of Mexican presidents selling out to the CIA. And now we know, you know, from Gustavo Díaz Ordaz from the 60s all the way through Echeverria.
Because Nixon recorded all the conversations as well, didn't he?
Thankfully for us, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
But he was also, because Mexico was maintaining relations with Cuba, was one of the few countries to do so. Right. And presumably that was, you know, given the tight relationship between Díaz Ordaz and Echeverria, was a kind of back channel for the Americans to get intelligence on the Castro government in their attempts to overthrow it.
That's exactly right. And I think that's what Keller shows in her book, that Mexico did play a double game. And actually, the fact that Mexico maintained diplomatic relationship with Cuba also bolstered its credentials, right, within the region and globally, without the global south, as like a non-aligned progressive government. But yeah, it's also passing along information to the Americans. And it's really complicated too, because like the head of Mexico's feared political police, the DFS, Fernando Gutierrez Barrios, like he was like really close to Fidel Castro. So there's all these like really, and Castro was for a variety of reasons, Fidel had to be tight with some of these Mexican presidents. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, and I think I make this point in the book, that this not just the two movements that I chronicle in the state of Guerrero, but Mexico had like 38 armed revolutionary movements throughout the 70s. It was as a collective and individually, these movements were probably the most isolated guerrilla movements in Latin America, because the one thing that I could never count on was any sort of even rhetorical support from the Cubans. Mm-hmm. And they were really on their own. And that also protected the PRI a lot.
That's interesting, because the reverberations of the Cuban Revolution were felt so strongly by those movements in Mexico. Yeah. And they were, you know, I think they were trying to emulate what had happened in Cuba. And I think the thinking was, you know, if they can do it in this little island of Cuba and, you know, tell the American Empire where to stick it, why can't we do that in Mexico? And so, you know, it's very sad, I think, that they couldn't count on support from Cuba. And presumably it's because the state relations between the two governments were.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think if I can read included in the book, there's this great quote by a campesina who from the 60s, Gregoria Nario, who talking about the impact of the Cuban Revolution, they asked her, like, you know, if she supported socialism. Like, I remember the exact question. Do you support Cuba or do you support socialism? And her response was, if socialism ensured food, education, health, and recreation for our children, then yes, the path was marked before us. And I was like, that's how a campesina who grew coffee in the mountains of Guerrero interpreted the impact of the Cuban Revolution, right? So in a sense, there's like many Cuban revolutions, because it depended on how these local communities and revolutionary movements interpreted the impact, right? It wasn't this idea that they were like, there wasn't like a mimesis, right? Like it was a lot more complex in terms of how people took the lessons and the symbolism of the Cuban Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's two interesting aspects to it, that there's a very internationalist scope to these guerrilla movements in Mexico, but a kind of very local nationalist feeling as well. So I don't know. I mean, I just kind of thought it was interesting how they were kind of feeding off and learning from other movements and reading a lot and educating themselves and educating each other. And, you know, the education by reading these Marxist texts was, you know, a sort of form of mutual support.
That's one of the things that continues to fascinate me, is like the different, as you mentioned, like the very local but also transnational reference that collectively create the revolutionary imaginations of these movements, right? So like So I mentioned in the book that Lucio Cabañas had like a mobile library that apparently even included a copy of John Womack's Zapata and the Mexican Revolution,
Oh,
right?
really?
There was a doctor, the doctor for Cabañas's group, the Party of the Poor. He had been a Spanish Republican exile. He had fought in the Spanish Civil War. He had received military training in the Soviet Union. After the movement lost in Spain, he comes to Venezuela and eventually settles in Guerrero. And then he ends up providing, at least we know, maybe provided more, but medical assistance to wounded guerrilla fighters. There's also a really fascinating history that's a lot of work has been done in Spanish, but not necessarily in English, of a movement called the Movimiento de Acción Revolucionaria, which was this revolutionary group that was begun by Mexican students who were studying on scholarship at the Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow. And they were there when the 1968 student massacre in Tlatelolco occurred. And when they saw that from Moscow, they said, look, we need to organize a revolutionary movement to overthrow this regime. So from the one of the militants, ex-militants that I interviewed for the book, he told me how they went and approached like every revolutionary embassy in Moscow seeking help. They went to the Vietnamese, the Algerians, they went the whole gamut. And the only one that said yes and provided training for at least up to 150 militants was North Korea. And then these guys go back to Mexico. And their movement flounders for a variety of reasons really quickly, but surviving members will then disperse and join other movements. And some of those members went and joined the Party of the Poor in Guerrero. And it seems like they're the ones who provided a lot of the training when it came to like ambush tactics, ambushing the military convoys in the state of Guerrero. So you have a really interesting like North Korean and Juche with like these guerrilla movements in Guerrero that are then they apply some of these tactics in their fight against the Mexican military that is then occupying Guerrero. It's really fascinating to me.
The other aspect which you touched on a little bit was the this sort of seeming contradiction, in which Mexico accepts all these refugees from, political refugees from all over the place, which I think goes back to the Cardenas government of the 1930s. So, and a lot of those people are Spanish Republicans, they're Chileans, they're Guatemalans. But the Spanish Republicans seem to have a quite an important cultural influence in Mexico. The founding of, I think, the Colegio de Mexico is by one of my friends worked at the Universidad del Mar in Oaxaca, and the rector, I mean, this was a few years ago, so the guy must have been really old, but the rector was a Spanish Republican, and a lot of the publishing houses in Mexico were founded by Spanish Republicans and so on. And so you got sometimes people talk about the Mexican states having this kind of schizophrenic quality, whereby it can at the same time accept these radicals from Chile and Spain and Guatemala and political refugees, while persecuting the exact same kind of people in their own backyard. Anyway, that's and I think that's, with Echeverria, that was the, that was the kind of genius of his, political rhetoric, was that, he was the leader of the third world, pro-Palestine, pro all these anti-colonial movements and so on, while engaging in this process of internal colonization and repression. Maybe we could go back a little bit and just talk about the kind of process that you had to go through in order to research this stuff. I mean, where do you go to find out about what's happened in this secret dirty war in the Mexican countryside that, the outside world doesn't know much about?
It's funny because when I proposed this topic to my mentor as an undergraduate, Professor Mirna Santiago, who's a historian of Mexico, and she, I remember her telling me like, "Well, you're gonna have a really difficult time finding primary sources." And then I went to graduate school and I heard the same answer. But I was lucky enough that in 2000, this charlatan was elected president in Mexico by the name of Vicente Fox. And one of the probably the only positive thing I think, and he did it for self-serving reasons, obvious now, he ordered the declassification of millions of military, Mexican military, spy agency and political police records. And this happened, they started declassifying them in I think like 2004, 2004 they started really coming out, 2005, which was right at the moment that I had started that I started my dissertation research. So it was just I got really lucky with the timing in terms of being one of the first to be able to access like millions of these untapped documents. Before
Which
that,
were not
though,
ordered, were they? I mean, were they? Was it like piles of documents that you just kind of?
No, they were. There was some order. Like the mm-hmm. military documents had order. They were ordered by year and by state. Which is a similar order for the IPS, which was like this more domestic spy agency, the Investigaciones yeah. Políticas y Sociales. The difficult one to deal with were the DFS, because as I write elsewhere in a journal article, like this was an archive of counterinsurgency. Like there's this was never meant to see the day of light. This was meant to help these agents get the information that they needed when they were following something, when following someone or trying to subvert or create chaos within an organization. So it's a highly organized archive. The problem is that when they declassified the archive and sent it over to the National Archive in Mexico City at the AGN, the Dark Palace of Lecumberri, which is, you know, Peter, but to describe it to people, it's a 19th century Benthamite panopticon prison that now serves as Mexico's National Archive, which is so rich in symbolism about history and power. But in one of the wings, they just like, in one of the prison wings, they just dumped this highly organized counterinsurgency archive. But they also sent along the archivist that had worked as an archivist for the DFS. So the gatekeeping remained. This man who's, I tell my students, one of the most frightening men I've met in my life, this really very short man by the name of Señor Capello. And the very first time I went in there to ask him about the documents and what I could look at, you know, I told him, I was trying to keep it really vague because I knew that the sensitive nature of my research. And he wouldn't stand for it. He was just like, no, I need, this archive is organized by names. So I need to know names. So that kind of gave me an insight into how this was organized. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned the names of the guerrilla organizations. And then he looked at me and he didn't say anything for like 20 seconds, just gave me this glare. And I'm just like, oh man, what did I do? And he responds with, why are you from Guerrero? Because that might be a problem. And I'm just like, no, I'm from the US. Like, just as an academic pursuit. And in that archive, they would only give you one document at a time. So they would give you a collection of 3x5 cards, and each card had a description of a corresponding document. You would look at the cards, you would write down the number of the document on a list. You would give the list to these ex-DFS agents who are now archivists. And they would hand you one. They would hand you these documents one by one. You couldn't get the next one until you gave the previous one back. Yeah. They would let you photocopy some things. Some documents they just wouldn't show me. So I had the 3x5 card, but they wouldn't show me the long document because of datos personales. Like there's personal information in there of someone who's still alive. It was really stressful to do research in that, in that archive. But it was an archive of counterinsurgency, and it had these documents, and agents had a particular optic in terms of how they viewed these movements. But even then, you know, reading against the grain, reading it in a really critical way, I was able to obtain some really important information. Mm-hmm. The other part of my primary source base involved the really laborious way of getting a lot of these ex-guerrilla fighters to trust me and to tell me their story in the form of oral histories. And that took me a long time, and I don't think I did enough of it. I wish I could have done more if I had more time. But that for me was the most powerful. I mean, these interviews profoundly changed me for life. Like when I came back from doing my research, my committee was like, what happened to you? Like, you're different. And the research changed me. You know, hearing these horrific stories of struggle, like very inspirational stories about struggle, right? But also like what they suffered, it was really impactful. And there was one instance where I got on a bus in Mexico City, and this bus eventually was going to make it to Chihuahua, to the site of another guerrilla movement, the Arturo Gamis movement that happened in the 1960s. And then between Mexico City and Chihuahua, we were picking up different ex-guerrilla fighters from different parts of Mexico. Mm-hmm. So for a week, I was on this bus sponsored by the PRD, which is really funny now. I didn't know anybody on the bus. I got invited, not knowing anybody. And just with like a recorder and a backpack and some notes and a little bit of clothes. And it's one of the most amazing weeks of my life. Like really meeting these people, listening to their stories. I mean, most of their stories were like, they would preface it by saying, this is for you, not for your research. So I have all these good stories, but I can't tell them, right? Because they trusted me with their stories. But, you know, being in that bus with them and going to these different battle sites and picking up militants from Guadalajara, from Culiacan, from Sonora, I really got an insight into the worldview of people who really thought that revolution was an imminent possibility in the 1970s. and they had no other options left, right? That this is that one of the points that I remember hearing on the bus was like the state, the pre was the generator, the maker of guerrillas, because they'd left us no other option.
Yeah.
And really trying to understand that mentality and the struggle and the sacrifices that required was something that I learned in a really meaningful way when I was on that bus for 7 days.
The oral testimony that you include in the book, I think, is like this, you know, the strongest, most powerful element of the stories that you're telling. I wonder if we could, I know I'm conscious of time that you've probably got to go soon, but maybe we could talk a little bit about what you're doing now and how this does, does this relate to the present? What the thing that really strikes me about your work is the way in which the past is the present, and that all of these struggles in Guerrero, which you could see as a kind of struggle for, you know, what's going on in Mexico generally, and perhaps all over Latin America, and even, you know, a lot of the third world. But, you know, how does that resonate with the present, and does it resonate with the present? It seems to me that the demands that people have been making since the colonial period, the demands of the Mexican Revolution, the Mexican Constitution, 1917, throughout the 40s and into the 60s, are very, very similar to what we see today.
Yeah, I think you're right. The demands haven't changed, right? You still have the same demand for land, for schools, for medical clinics, for justice, for liberty, for a life, being allotted the possibility of living a life of dignity, right? And taking care of your families and your communities. I mean, these are really simple demands, but depending on the context, they're revolutionary demands. And the fact that they're still here in Guerrero in 2023, like, shows how revolutionary they are. And it speaks to, centuries of mal gobierno, they would say in Mexico, right? And that's why in certain instances, you have cries of muera el mal gobierno, death to bad government. Everything I talk about in the book, man, like, comes back in the 90s, which is, again, this is one of the reasons why I can't let go of this state, why my current research focuses on Guerrero. It's like, you have another cycle of guerrilla movements that broke out in Guerrero in the 1990s, before and after the more famous EZLN Chiapas guerrillas that became world famous. And it's almost the same thing, like, some of the same people, like the horrific despotic governor in Guerrero in the 1970s, it was his son in the 1990s who helped spark these guerrilla movements by massacring innocent people. One of the things that I feel like I didn't do enough of in the book, because it wasn't the focus of it, and it is the focus of my current book project, is really to dive into the dirty war, like, to think about why this dirty war happened. Is it a dirty war? How can we rethink this idea of what is a dirty war in Guerrero in the 1970s? But I'm also telling the story because I think it's inextricably linked. This is also the emergence of something we can call a drug war in Mexico, right? So drug war in the sense of it being more of a counterinsurgency as a war against poor people than as a drug interdiction program led by police agents like Gene Hackman in The French Connection. Like, this is a war against poor people, which, so I'm trying to tell this in my current book project. I'm trying to tell the story of how the drug war actually begins as this dirty war that I mention a little bit in the book. And that this form of counterinsurgency becomes a way of governance, of sovereignty. If you're not going to meet the demands of the people, because it would then require a radical restructuring of society, of economics, of politics, then the other alternative is to just keep hitting them over the head with a form of kind of permanent counterinsurgency. How do you justify that to the rest of the country, to the globe? Well, you justify it by saying, well, actually, this isn't a counterinsurgency. This is a war on drugs. And what makes it real is that Guerrero actually did start to produce a lot of drugs in the 1970s, particularly heroin. But they're only doing that because there's massive demand exploding in the United States. Yeah. So the current book project I'm writing about is really trying to understand what has happened in Mexico since 2006, since Felipe Calderón, the ex-president, declared a war on drugs that has led to, like, hundreds of thousands of deaths and more than 100,000 disappearances, like, stuff that I never would have imagined possible when I was researching this book, when I was researching 1,000 people disappear, which is already horrific, but now we're at a level in Mexico where it's like industrial. So I'm really trying to find an origin point to some of the current violence that's inflicting Mexico. And I say that a key one is in the 1970s in the state of Guerrero, where counterinsurgency and the drug war kind of become the same thing, and it morphs into a way of governance where politics become replaced by bullets, essentially, continuously. And if that's going to be the case, then that's going to produce popular responses. Mm-hmm. And if you keep shutting off the possibilities of options of popular responses, then at some point you're going to get a form of armed struggle, at the very least armed self-defense, which we see now, yeah. Or in some instances, revolutionary armed struggle, which happened in the 1990s.
In the 60s and 70s in Mexico, and throughout the, you know, a lot of the dictatorships of the Southern Cone, there was a clear ambition to rid those countries of political opposition, of supposed subversives, Marxists, mm-hmm. etc. And you know, in Argentina, that was the sort of state policy, right? Get rid of the opposition. And in Mexico too, right? You've got about 1,000 people probably documented as disappeared during the dirty war there, although, as you say in the book, the Guerrero seems to be littered with mass graves, and nobody really knows how many people were mm-hmm. murdered and disappeared. And then we get to this recent period since 2006, the drug war. And, you know, when you look at the numbers, this is on the scale, on a bigger scale than what we see during the dirty war in Argentina or in Chile or Uruguay, possibly even in Guatemala as well. But there doesn't seem to be a central kind of goal. And that's what I kind of find difficult to grapple with. It's like, why? What's the aim of this violence? You know, as Hannah Arendt says, you know, violence yeah. always has a purpose. What's the purpose of this violence, which has spiraled completely out of control? Where you've seen, I mean, I don't know how many people have disappeared since 2006. The numbers are like astonishing, yeah. or have been forced, have been murdered extrajudicially. And it seems that there's a pact between organized crime groups, local level politicians, high level politicians, police forces, the military, and it's a very neoliberal kind of violence in the sense that, you know, nowadays, if you want to, you know, you want to blame somebody for your conditions in life, who do you blame? It's because we're all governed by corporations, essentially, and the state is bought by corporations. And in the same way, the violence is kind of faceless. Who do you blame? It's like, where do you go? You know, it doesn't seem to, in the case of Argentina, you had the Argentine Dirty Wars and the warriors and the military. And after the Dirty War ended, you went after the you know, civic organizations went after them. In Mexico, it seems that that's much more difficult. Am I wrong in thinking that?
No, I think you've identified, Peter, like one of the big questions that drives my current research, and just, I think it's a huge question that drives some of my political thinking. I don't have an answer to it. I think, you know, some people have approached this question recently in a really creative way. So the sociologist and journalist Dawn Paley has a really good article where she talks about the difference between Cold War disappearances and neoliberal disappearances, and how, in her view, you know, she's thinking about what neoliberal capitalism, what it requires and what it doesn't require. And one of the things that it doesn't require are these things called surplus populations. Well, how you deal with surplus populations whose labor you don't need, whose surplus value you don't need, but they do tend to get in the way by simply, in some cases, living on land that on top of like valuable resources that transnational corporations want. So what better way to get to that land than to, you know, help finance some sort of like local fighting between different criminal organizations that then leads to displacement of these people. And it allows the entrance of a certain transnational corporation to take advantage of the resources that were on that land. I mean, that's one possible way to think about it, but I it's an ongoing open question. I think one of the things in my research that I, anytime I talk about this in public, I really try to emphasize, like, there isn't like the good state versus the bad narcos. And there's no clear dividing line. And if you look at the history of how the drug traffic even emerged, like Ben Smith's latest, like really fun and brilliant book, The Dope, this Mexican state incubated the very traffic and traffickers and logics that now have gotten out of control. Mm-hmm. So it's more of what's that saying in Spanish? It's uno propone y Dios dispone. It's kind of like you propose, but God determines. Like it's, mm-hmm. El narco propone y el estado dispone, right? Like it's the narco proposes, but the state determines what's allowed and what isn't allowable. And so like, it's really hard to disentangle what's going on. And that only helps create more confusion at the local level. Like I've worked on as an expert witness for people who have fled Guerrero and they're trying to win asylum and refuge in the US. And that's like the overall sense that I get from them. They don't know where the violence is coming from. And that's really frightening. They know that there's a criminal organization. They know that they're living near a mine that's owned by a Canadian mining company that may or may not be working at some point with that local narco organization. But they're suffering violence and they don't necessarily know why. So they flee. I don't know if I can get any more neoliberal than that, right? As you described it, that's really frightening.
And, you know, in terms of, you know, people seeking asylum, you know, it's very difficult to then make a case, you know, if you're an expert witness, that these people are being persecuted because they don't fit into those categories. Are they being persecuted because of their political beliefs, their religion, their gender, their sexual orientation? Why are they being persecuted? And so it's very difficult to, you know, in these cases of people who have to flee for very real reasons, how do you make that case? Sometimes
Guerrero has become completely fragmented in terms of, as a result of drug war policy, in terms of who controls what part of the state. Like it used to be one or two organizations, and now pretty much and Guerrero has like 83, 84 municipalities. Like there's, you know, probably that many different local armed groups who are in control of these areas. So when you go to a judge and you say, this such and such group is threatening the life of this person, the judge will, as what happened one time to me, was like, well, I don't recognize this cartel name. They're not one of the famous ones. So do they even exist? And I'm just like, that's not how this works, right? But you're trying to make a case. So in addition to not fitting the categories, if you don't even have the name of like quote unquote cartel name that a U.S. authority in this case knows about, then it makes it even more difficult. In addition to just not fitting the category that should grant them asylum.
Absolutely. Well, Alex, you know, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I really hope we can do this again sometime. Hopefully when your next book comes out. Do you know when that's going to be? Or is that should I not ask?
Don't ask me that, man.
Okay,
don't
I won't ask. I'll see you in about 10 years.
Hopefully.
Then.
Not 10 years. Less than that.
Okay. But well, hopefully I would love to continue this discussion, and maybe we can do so even if before the book comes out. Episode, because I had so many more questions to ask, and I'm sure there's lots more we can discuss. People who are interested in your work, in Alex's work, the book is called Spectres of Revolution, and it's published by Oxford University Press. And they can find you on Twitter. And remember, he's got his own webpage, which I think is what's the address?
Just alexanderavina.com.
Cool. Okay. Excellent. And so thanks for listening or watching, and please subscribe to Alborada on whatever platform you're watching or listening, and we'll see you in the next episode. Thank you.